Level 2 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 263. Defending Zion, George Q. Cannon and the California Mormon Newspaper Wars of 1856 to 1857. A paper presented by Roger Eakins with readings by Will Bagley.
He's a man who's insulting good looks and native brilliance is only overshadowed by his deep sense of personal humility.
You're not supposed to tell my wrote that. Actually, that's Will Bagley we're talking about. The late Will Bagley.
And Will Bagley, who we hope shows up here. There he is.
Good time.
Oh. This is Will Bagley.
Here's the intro.
Oh,
there you go.
Okay. He lives in Salt Lake City with his wife and two children. He attended Brigham Young University and is a graduate of the University of California, Santa Cruz. He's edited several historical narratives, including Frontiersman, Abner Blackburn Narrative with Harold Schindler. He revised Dale L. Morgan Classic West from Fort Bridger. With his brother, cartoonist Pat Bagley, he published This is the Place, A Crossroad of Utah's Past, a children's book. He serves as the editor of Arthur Clarke's Kingdom in the West series. And of course, I think some of you were in his session yesterday where he talked about his book, Blood of the Prophets. And in his biographical information, he wrote that he hasn't been exed yet. I can tell you from personal experience, the worst thing that can happen next to excommunication is to be called the ward nursery leader. That happened to me. As soon as these gentlemen are ready, I will turn the time over to them. Do you want me to tell?
You're assuming a lot.
Do you want me to tell a few jokes or something?
No, we're almost there.
Okay.
We're there.
Okay.
All right. Okay.
Getting our act together.
Yeah. Good to have you here. Thanks for being here. If you brought your cell phones with you, please turn them off. That'd be great. That would be nice. It's like every session I'm in, one person's cell phone goes out. Following years of secret practice and public denial, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints finally admitted to the practice of polygamy in 1852. Following that public acknowledgement, increasingly vehement criticism of the Utah Mormons became a significant preoccupation of the national press. In an effort to defend the church against such criticism, while also hoping to provide additional organs for proselytizing to the Gentile world, Brigham Young established four new periodicals. Apostle Orson Pratt was sent to Washington, D.C. to publish The Seer, a journal specifically designed to advocate for and defend polygamy. Apostle and future president of the church, John Taylor, was selected as the publisher-editor of The Mormon, based in New York City. Apostle Erastus Snow was assigned to the St. Louis Luminary, and a lowly returned missionary, George Q. Cannon, destined to serve as first counselor to four church presidents, and the man who arguably would become the most powerful voice for 19th century Mormonism after Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, was assigned at the tender age of 28, to edit and publish a newspaper in San Francisco. Of these four periodicals, the Western Standard was clearly the most interesting, at least in my opinion. Cannon pulled no punches as he took on one journalistic enemy after another. Perhaps it was the courage and even recklessness that comes with youth that made Cannon so bold in his attacks. Perhaps it was because he had not yet been saddled with the sober responsibilities of the apostleship that made him more fiery than Pratt, Snow, or even at times his uncle John Taylor. Whatever the reason, George Q. Cannon successfully started and more often than not ended a number of newspaper wars that are still fascinating to read or hear today. At least we hope you'll find a couple of them fascinating. This presentation is extracted from my forthcoming book, and Will wanted to say a little bit about the series, and so why don't you go ahead and do that.
Oh,
take the book. Nothing like show and tell. And it's interesting that I believe that the most significant work that I will do as a historian is editing the Arthur H. Clarke series, Kingdom in the West, The Mormons and the American Frontier, which is projected in at least 15 volumes. We've actually now got 20 potential titles. That is a documentary history of the Mormon West. These are the sources. These are the people speaking for themselves. These are the tales told by the people who were there. And I find these sources captivating reading. We've already published 4 volumes. All of them except the Samuel Brannan Journal have won awards, and some have won multiple awards. David Bigler's Overview History, Forgotten Kingdom, won Best Book from the Westerners International. The latest volume is Army of Israel, Mormon Battalion Narratives. One of the sleeper parts of the series are the women's letters. Take a look at the women's letters in this volume, and they'll tear your heart out. I'm quite delighted that out of the blue, Roger Eakins sent me Defending Zion, George Q. Cannon, and the California Mormon Newspaper Wars of 1856-1857, and it is a perfect contribution to the series. It adds several important dimensions. It sets the stage for the conflict that takes place in 1857, the Utah War, which in many ways will be the centerpiece of the series. It will be documented probably in 2 volumes by William McKinnon, who has studied it. He's a brilliant historian. He's worked on it for 40 years. He has documents that will give us an entirely new picture. But Roger's perspective is the best defense of Mormonism made in the 19th century. And I find it a little ironic that the session that I did on the most controversial subject and disturbing subject on Mormon history is packed, and the one about the defense of 19th century Mormonism, there's plenty of seats and you guys can all spit out and be comfortable. But Roger's done a wonderful job collecting these great sources, and it's balanced between the attacks on Mormonism, which gives you a sense of not only the attitudes, the conflicts of attitudes, but the fanaticism that the church faced and the fear that it generated among outsiders and the absolutely unvarnished hatred. And it gives you a good perspective on why the Mormons were themselves fearful and why that they felt that they had to defend themselves at any cost. Because when people say they want to hang you up like pirates, it's likely to inspire at least a defensive reaction.
Well, this paper will focus on some especially engaging exchanges between Cannon's Western Standard and 2 other California newspapers. The first will be The Pacific, a self-proclaimed weekly journal devoted to religion, education, and useful intelligence. The second combatant will be the Daily California American, the precursor to today's very prominent Sacramento Bee. As the presentation proceeds, I'll be reading righteously indignant editorials written by Cannon, as Will gives more of a superior voice to the editors of The Pacific and Daily California American, both of which so often found themselves under unrelenting fire by the young Cannon. And I'm sure we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers at the end, we hope. Hang them up like pirates, the Mormons, saints, or sinners. Though they called themselves saints, the Mormons never thought of themselves as perfect. Many of Joseph Smith's revelations reminded them of their individual and collective shortcomings. Nonetheless, they considered themselves God's chosen people and firmly believed it would be through their efforts that the Lord's second coming would soon become reality. Their enemies, old as well as new, accused the Latter-day Saints of every foul deed imaginable. There was nothing new about the crimes attributed to the Mormons by the California newspapers. Witness the following list compiled by the infamous John C. Bennett, the formerly mayor of Nauvoo, Major General of the Nauvoo Legion, and Assistant President of the Church in his 1842 attack on his erstwhile brethren.
It appears from the mass of evidence in this expose that the Mormon hierarchy are guilty of infidelity, deism, atheism, lying, deception, blasphemy, debauchery, lasciviousness, bestiality, madness, fraud, plunder, larceny, burglary, robbery, perjury, fornication, adultery, rape, incest, arson, treason, and murder. And they have out-heroded Herod and out-deviled the devil.
In the program notes, we said this was, would be a dramatic reading. I was counting on Will for that. Given his own questionable character, Bennett's charges are highly suspect. Whether a fallen believer or a conniving opportunist, Bennett had been excommunicated for many of the moral lapses he denounced. His objections to Joseph Smith's polygamous relations were less the result of moral outrage, I suspect, than of personal jealousy. Still, the depredations allegedly committed by Joseph Smith's Danites and Brigham Young's destroying angels provided plenty of smoke, if not fire, to blacken the moon of early Mormonism. By 1856, there was no lack of controversial topics useful in attacking the young religion. As the voice of the LDS Church in California, Keenan had to fend off charges involving the character of Joseph Smith, Utah theocracy under Brigham Young, the Willie Martin handcart disaster, and of course, scandalous tales of young women abducted into sexual slavery by the crafty elders of Salt Lake.
The venomous political controversies of the time, driven by sectionalism and battles over slavery cloaked as popular sovereignty, fueled the blasts frontier editors leveled against Mormonism in general and the Western Standard in particular. At the very least, the Latter-day Saints were vulnerable to the charge of prevarication. As both sides denounced each other as liars throughout the California newspaper wars, the Mormons were at a severe disadvantage, having steadfastly and often heatedly denied the practice of polygamy prior to their belated acknowledgement of that peculiar institution in 1852. Wanting to be perceived as completely honest in all matters, in spite of this history of obfuscation, led to some interesting rationalizations. Joseph F. Smith, son of Joseph Smith's brother Hiram, and future president of the church, tried to justify his father's early denials of polygamy. Quote, "There's a vast difference between telling a lie and not telling the truth. Webster says, polygamy, a man having several wives, or a woman having several husbands. The latter part, my father meant to deny, and not the former. Therefore, he did not lie." Thomas B. Marsh, who would have been head of the 12 apostles in place of Brigham Young had he not apostatized, claimed Danite founder Samson Abard advocated lying for the support of their religion and said it was no harm to lie for the Lord. Following the model set by Joseph Smith's public denials of polygamy, Mormon leaders on the frontier felt perfectly justified in lying for the Lord to protect their embattled religion.
I'll be there in a minute anyway. When the San Francisco Pacific reprinted a richly imaginative story about the crimes and moral degeneracy reigning in Utah Territory, Judge Buchanan immediately responded, launching a lengthy newspaper battle that eventually drew in the Daily California American. The episode affords a glimpse into the psyche of Americans in general and Californians in particular as they tried to make sense of the theocratic, communalistic, and polygamic system known as Mormonism. Westerners, especially those living on the borders of Utah Territory, perceived this encounter with the other as a clear and present danger, as is obvious from the unrelenting editorial opprobrium Western newspapers hurled at the Saints. Whether Cannon truly believed he could deflect such criticism by pointing out the logical fallacies of his opponents while often returning their vituperation is an open question, but he did not shrink from his mission to portray his people as more sinned against than sinning.
Mormonism, the Pacific, November 6, 1856. Among a party of 900 Mormons who recently left comfortable homes in England to surrender to the sway of Brigham Young and his hopeful associates came two girls whose transfer to the Utah land of abomination has the very character of kidnapping. The story of their flight, as related in the English papers, follows. Their father was a man of middle life, well-to-do and industrious. His labors had placed his family, consisting of a wife and several children, in a state of decent competence and happiness. Satan came among them in the guise of a Mormon emissary and beguiled the eldest son, who made a pilgrimage to the land of rogues. True to their instinct, the crafty elders of Salt Lake made Mormonism so delightful to the neophyte and advanced him so very rapidly in their fraternity that he returned to England as a preacher of the delusion. The father, whose employment took him away from his family for periods of a week at a time, returned to his house one Saturday from a business excursion to find it deserted. His whole family had disappeared with whatever portables they could lay their hands upon, and his wife had stolen his money to no inconsiderable amount, all that she could collect or pilfer. He traced the fugitives to Liverpool and reached that place to discover that they had embarked, under the persuasions of the Mormon son, in an immigrant ship, the Enoch Train, a model of which you can see in the Church Museum of History and Art. The distracted father chartered a steam tug and, taking with him a police officer, overtook the vessel. After an infinite deal of persuasion, aided by the master of the ship and opposed by the Mormon leaders, he succeeded in inducing his wife to go back with him. He also, as a matter of great favor, obtained the surrender of his infant children. But his two eldest daughters refused to return with their parents, and the heartbroken father went without them. Their fate, going thus unprotected to Utah, may well cause a shudder. A community thus replenished is maturing measures to apply for admission as one of the states of this Confederacy. We were never among those who calculated the value of the Union or who dreamed of the possibility of its being sundered was among the contingencies to be considered in any case. But the possibility that our fathers had fought to establish a shield for a community of adulterers and bigamists and their progeny makes us pause. And all of this evil, if it is to be consummated, will be fairly charged upon the absurdity of squatter sovereignty, a demagogue's figment to serve a party purpose, carried to its legitimate deductions by knaves, operating through the instrumentality of zealots, fanatics, fools, and lechers. We have no patience with the Mormons, and as little with temporizers who leave the evil to increase until at last a literal bloody war may be forced upon us to crush what common sense and a just idea of the power of the general government might have averted. The contact with the Mormons of such settlers of the West as have great ideas of purity and decency will be terrible whenever the tide of immigration reaches them. And if the descendants of the wretches now wallowing in Mormonism, meaning you, modern vermin perpetrating their kind in the disgusting ratio of other loathsome creatures, if we say these children of such paternity do not form a pariah race in our country, it will be because this bad leaven taints the whole moral mass. Extremes meet. We have enjoyed a high order of social virtue in this Republican country because no corrupt royalty or nobility have made illegitimacy tolerable and recommended the bend sinister as a badge of honor, provided that the blood, no matter how, by what questionable vein it descends, be honorable. But if squatter sovereignty and liberty deteriorating into licentiousness produce the same result, we have not only Fitz Youngs and Fitz Mormons for Fitz Jameses and Fitz Clarences, and certainly have not gained much in the exchange.
Pacific Post and Mormonism, Western Standard, 15 November, 1856. The Pacific of last week and the Pathfinder and Post of the 12th instant contain an article on Mormonism extracted from the Philadelphia American, which exceeds in bitterness, vituperation, and filthy epithets anything you have seen upon the subject for a long time. and which exhibits the deep corruption of the heart and brain of the writer. The language it contains may be much more becoming frequenters of the Five Points in New York or Billingsgate in London than the mouth of an American editor. And we're surprised to see any paper in the state disgrace its columns by its insertion. We can only account for its appearance on the supposition that some of the California editorial fraternity, being destitute of the necessary amount of brains to concoct stories about the Mormons, have been compelled to have recourse to foreign aid in order to gratify their malicious propensities toward us. We do not profess to be so expert in the use of slang phrases and low vulgarisms as the editor of the American, nor do we wish to degrade ourselves to his level by adopting his course, for says the wise man, "Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou be like unto him." There is one thing, however, which we would remind gentlemen of, and that is that selecting all the scurrilous and abusive words from a dictionary and arranging them in consecutive order, though it may exhibit a certain degree of smartness, is not argument. And though it may pander to and please the passions of the vulgar, I notice many of you are enjoying that, unthinking crowd, it will not only fail to convince, but will disgust every sensible and reflecting man and woman. There's not an objection raised in the article to which we allude that what could be easily and satisfactorily answered, but we do not consider it worthy of a reply, for it carries its own reputation on its face. And the only reason we notice it is because it shows the mean, cowardly, underhanded course which certain editors in this city are determined to pursue toward us and our principles. And because it is also a tolerably correct criterion of their taste, crows flock to carrion, but its very scent is sufficient to drive away birds of cleaner tastes and purer instincts. Why is it, gentlemen, that you are compelled to resort to such means to sustain your position? We are here to debate with you the principles of Mormonism on their own merits, and to answer your objections against them, if you have any. We invite discussion. We court inquiry. Bring forth your strong reasoning. Show us our errors. Prove Mormonism to be false, either from the Bible or nature. We will meet you on these grounds, but no. Instead of pursuing this manly, consistent, straightforward course, you sneak away behind the invincible barrier of some absurd story that's been hatched up by some charitable, disinterested man as the editor of the American from 3 to 10,000 miles away, and about which neither of us know as much as a monkey does of algebra. And then you valiantly stick your heads out of your hiding places and call upon us to refute these ridiculous offshoots of a diseased brain, when you well know that it's impossible for us to obtain the necessary proof to do so. Shame on such a contemptible subterfuge. We ask again, why is it that you pursue such a course? We are compelled to conclude that it is either because you have learned by past experience that reason is not a weapon that can be used against Mormonism, that no sound argument can be brought to bear against it, or else that you really do not know enough to conduct an argument on the subject. If the latter is the case, we advise you not to open your mouths again until you have something to say. But you remember the fable of the ass, who, when attired in the skin of a lion, passed very well for that noble animal until he attempted to imitate his roar when his bray betrayed his true nature.
As one of the propagators of Mormonism in the Sandwich Islands, it is hardly surprising that Cannon responded forcefully when the California press attacked Mormon missionary efforts in Hawaii. As he often would, Cannon used an eloquent defense of American liberties to decry his opponent's ill-considered call to hang them up like pirates, and to point out the unfortunate effects Protestant missionary efforts had on Polynesian culture and morals. Taking the bait, the editor of the California American tried to defend his somewhat exaggerated language, providing Cannon with another opportunity to blast this intemperate burst of indignation. And Cannon began his editorial, Mormonism in the Sandwich Island, from December 6, 1856, with a quote from the California American. "The Mormons are preaching their accursed doctrine in the Sandwich Islands, of all places in the world needing the prevalence of just the opposite principles of social conduct. The great obstacle in the way of civilization in that quarter has always been the strong tendency of the people to licentiousness. It has been in some measure surmounted and might be fully overcome, but for the advent of this new ism into that region. The propagators of such a monstrous evil as Mormonism would be in the islands, emerging as they are from semi-civilized condition, and after so many years of patient labor on the part of the better classes of the natives to advance the general welfare, ought to be hung up like pirates.
The above is an editorial item from the columns of the Sacramento paper, the California American, Saturday last, and is strikingly indicative of the spirit of murder and bloodshed which dwells in the breast of many who hold themselves up as guides of public opinion and teachers of virtue, good order, and peace. Every honest, peaceable, and upright man must be disgusted with such sentiments and cannot but execrate the spirit that would dictate their utterance. Men who permit themselves to be actuated by such feelings are unworthy of the society of their fellow men and should be shunned as enemies of their race. Had they lived in the days of Christ, they would have been in the crowd who cried, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Or had they been present at the execution of Stephen, they would doubtless have rubbed their hands in glee should they have lacked the courage to throw the stones. Such men filled the cells of the Inquisition with victims and caused the streets of Paris to flow with the blood of those who dared to think differently from themselves. And had they the power today, they would have another St. Bartholomew and the Latter-day Saints as their victims. If the Latter-day Saints are preaching accursed doctrines on the Sandwich Islands, they are preaching accursed doctrines here in California. For we preach but the one doctrine wherever we go. And as in the opinion of the editors of the California American, the penalty for propagating Mormonism there should be to be hung up like pirates, if they would but express their feelings, they would advocate the visitation of the same penalty upon its propagators here. And as its believers all become propagators the moment they become acquainted with it, the hanging process would have to be extended to every member of the society throughout the earth. Are the editors of the California American prepared for such a consummation? We had the honor to be one of the first propagators of Mormonism on the Sandwich Islands, and we were the first individual who preached what the editors of the California American are pleased to term the accursed doctrines of Mormonism to those islanders in their own language. Before they go, therefore, to those lands to execute the sanguinary vengeance they've decreed against the Mormons, they'd better commence with us. As we have not only been guilty of propagating Mormonism there, but are also engaged in the same delightful occupation here, and the Lord being our helper, intend to follow the business for the remainder of our life and throughout the endless ages of eternity. Before we commence, however, they had better weigh well the consequences of such a movement and be prepared to meet them, as the shedding of the blood of one Latter-day Saint will be the seed from which such an abundant harvest will be raised that the extirpation of their system would be impossible. We know that the doctrines taught both on the islands and here, and in fact throughout the world, by the Mormons are not accursed, only in the estimation of Satan and his agents. Neither is their system a monstrous evil. As we've been a propagator of these doctrines there, it is but reasonable to suppose that we have a little knowledge on this subject. The people were and are now being taught to believe on Jesus Christ, the Son of God, with all their hearts. Do the editors of the California American think this an accursed doctrine? They've been shown that baptism for the remission of sins was necessary. Is this what they would phrase an accursed doctrine? They've also been exhorted to walk uprightly, to deal justly, to forsake and abhor everything licentious or corrupt. Do they term these doctrines accursed? These are the doctrines taught by the Latter-day Saints to the Sandwich Islanders, Californians, and people of every land for their obedience, and every doctrine antagonistic to this is not Mormonism. It is a poor plan and a very great evidence of weakness for men to recommend the hangman's rope as an argument to arrest the progress of Mormonism. Though very potent in its way, it's not very apt to show men their errors or to cause men of firmness to abjure them. Such an argument in the hands of tyrants and despots may be a terror to slaves and sycophants, but when used by an American editor towards freemen, the only feelings it gives rise to are those of pity and contempt for the man who would so far forget himself as to use them.
This next part will be unfamiliar to you because it involves eating words. Our call in our previous issue to hang them up like pirates was the result of a momentary burst of indignation upon reading as an item of news from the Sandwich Islands that the monstrosity of Mormonism was gaining a foothold in that region. The language is somewhat exaggerated, it is true, for we can hardly be supposed to be literally in favor of publicly executing Mormon preachers. Detestable as they undoubtedly are, and however well deserving of the fate of common felons, for however beneficial it might be to the interests of humanity to extirpate by law so monstrous an evil as Mormonism from the face of the earth, yet it would be dangerous to the rights of man and to the great doctrine of liberty of conscience to establish in this government or any other such a precedent. A departure from the great Republican principle of free toleration of religious opinions in a solitary instance would endanger the principle itself and tend to revive in its full force a policy which the past experience of civilized nations has shown had better be allowed to slumber among the things that were. For the Mormons themselves, we have no respect. We mean the leaders of the sect. But we do respect the great principle under which they seek shelter, which, like the rain from heaven that falls upon the just as well as the unjust, is for them as well as any other class of men. Had we the power to control our national legislation, we would restrain the hand of destruction aimed at the Mormons, odious as they are, and repugnant to every sentiment of decency among us, not for their sake, but for the sake of our country. We would not strike them down for the same reason that we would not tear down a splendid monument to the genius of architecture whose massive pillars and sky-reaching dome the labor of a century had reared for the purpose of extracting or putting to death a miserable reptile that had hid within its walls. No, rather let it live, that it should issue forth at times to hiss and stink and strike at all it meets. So much we would not do, and so far do we qualify the language of the paragraph above quoted. But we do not hesitate to say that could it be done with safety to the principle of which we have spoken, the propagators of a general system of licentiousness like that of Mormonism, so open, shameless, and indecent in its everyday workings, so destructive of every quality that ennobles man and distinguishes him from the brutes, ought to be hung up, every one of them, as the common enemies of mankind. We have thus taken the pains to explain our precise meaning in the paragraph in question, because it was taken up as a text by the Mormon Standard at San Francisco of Saturday's issue, upon which to write a long article denouncing us for the expression of such a sentiment. The editor of that sheet supposes to tell us that we are literally in favor of hanging up Mormons or making the policy of the country to do so, and intimates that if such a course is to be pursued, we had better begin with him, as he has preached Mormonism in both the Sandwich Islands and California. We do not deny that, were we engaged in such a business, we should consider the editor of a Standard to be a fit subject for our attention, and we should take occasion to say to him, since he seems to desire our notice, that while we pity a poor, miserable fanatic who knows no better than to be led by the nose into the filthy slough of a most foul and monstrous superstition, we scorn, with every feeling of manhood that is in us, the lying hypocrite who knows that what he preaches is false, and not only false, but destructive of the very best interests of society, as it is the deadliest blow
blight upon virtue and morality. We know enough, well enough, that more than we can expect to thrive upon what they call persecution, that they would delight in getting into controversies with respectable newspapers. But we will, nevertheless, so far humor them on this occasion as to tell them in plain terms what they are, at any rate, how they're estimated by decent people. They are considered hypocrites and impostors, a foul blot upon humanity, which ought at once to be wiped out, and that they are tolerated at all is owing not to any regard for them, but to the principles of religious tolerance, under which, with all their loathsome vileness, they have sense enough to know that they can be protected. The sledgehammer, which is to knock out their brains, is not legislation, but public opinion, and we are satisfied to let it do its work. California American on Mormonism, Western Standard, 20 December, 1856. In our issue of the 6th instant, we republished an item from the editorial columns of the California American of Scaramento, headed Mormonism. I don't know whether Canon, whether that typo was intentional or not. It's one of the things you put sick with a question mark, who knows. I like it, I like Scaramento. Headed Mormonism in the Sandwich Islands, in which it was stated by the editor of that paper that the propagators of Mormonism on those islands ought to be hung up like pirates. In our comments upon the article, we expressed our unqualified condemnation of the spirit and sentiment which it contained, remarking that if hanging ought to be the penalty for preaching Mormonism there, we were equally liable here, as Mormonism was the same, wherever taught. The editor of the American, in another article on this subject in last week's paper, states that the item in question was the result of a momentary burst of indignation, and that he would not wish to be understood as being literally in favor of publicly executing Mormon preachers. He then delivers his opinion on the benefits of free toleration of religious opinions, etc., and what he would do for the Mormons had he the power to control our national legislation, that he would restrain the hand of destruction aimed at the Latter-day Saints, not for their sake, but for the sake of the country. So far, he attempts to qualify the language of the paragraph in question. But he has no sooner finished his qualifying remarks than he says that could it be done with safety to the principle of free toleration, the propagators of a system like that of Mormonism ought to be hung up, every one of them, as the common enemies of mankind. And again he says that they are a foul blot upon humanity, which ought at once to be wiped out. Was it another burst of indignation that called forth these last sentiments? We suppose that we must set it down as such and consider the language somewhat exaggerated, as there is so little difference between these sentiments and the sentiments of the paragraph which he has attempted to qualify, and which he says was the result of a momentary burst of indignation and contained language somewhat exaggerated, that we can scarcely detect any difference. We are pleased with the editor's fondness that he is subject to such fits when he reads anything about the progress of Mormonism, as we shall be able hereafter to overlook any exaggerated language that he may indulge in when treating upon this subject. Still under the influence of this burst of indignation, however, he goes on indulging in some very vulgar and ungentlemanly language toward ourself, giving us his opinion of Mormons in general and ourself in particular, informing us what he would do with us were he hangman, that if that were his business, he would consider us fit subject for his attention. All of which, after the explanation he has given, we conclude to be the unmeaning, exaggerated ravings of a man who has a strange habit, whenever the progress of Mormonism is alluded to, of writing about hanging men up like pirates, when in reality he does not wish to be so understood. Not being subject to a momentary burst of indignation, nor being in the habit of dealing in exaggeration, we confess that we cannot compete with the editor of the American in the use of low, abusive, and ungentlemanly epithets. In this, he excels us. His past education and experience have given him such ready command of ribaldry that we must forever despair of being able to emulate him. Our sense of self-respect and neighborly courtesy, if nothing else, would forbid the attempt. But as the average American is probably not aware of the fact that slang and abuse do not pass among sensible and well-bred people for argument and ability, we take the pains to enlighten him, and to inform him also that the use of such terms as lying hypocrite, miserable fanatic, imposter, filthy monstrosity, foul superstition, etc., only betrays a mean and ignoble spirit, that by its proficiency in vulgarity would endeavor to hide its lack of sense. He is of the opinion that the Latter-day Saints expect to thrive on persecution, and that they would delight in getting into controversies with respectable newspapers, insinuating, of course, that he is respectable, and that we ought to submit quietly and resignedly to any insults or abuse to which he may give vent whenever he is seized with one of his bursts of indignation. That is the idea conveyed throughout his whole article. He said the Romans ought to be hung up like pirates. We've had the temerity to condemn the sentiment, though uttered by the editor of the California American, and because we have done this, we must be bespattered by the filthy emanations of the brain and pen of a man who calls himself respectable. Now, we wish the editor of the American to distinctly understand that whenever he shall so forget himself as to give utterance to a sentiment similar to that with which we found fault, and which he attempted to qualify, we shall unhesitatingly condemn and expose it. We do not seek either persecution or controversy. But if there be the consequences of our condemning odious, tyrannical, and unrighteous sentiments, let them come, and we will do our best to prepare for them. We have been educated to believe that we have an equal right with every other citizen of this republic to express our dissent to everything arbitrary and intolerant, and the fact that we are a Latter-day Saint will never hinder us from exercising it. The religious tolerance of which he speaks and under which he says we have sought protection is not a privilege granted unto us. Neither is it anything for which we should be thankful to him or any other man. It's our inalienable right, our birthright, bestowed upon us by deity himself, and though we may be deprived of it by despots, it is still a right for which we shall ever contend.
The Mormons again. Daily California American, December 22nd, 1856. The editor of the Standard accuses us of using low, abusive, and ungentlemanly epithets and says something about our, quote, past education and experience, fitting us for ribaldry. Those who know us, and not strangers, are the best judge of our past education and experience, and they will bear us out when we say that our past education and experience never led us into such vile and shameless conduct as is the everyday practice of Mormonism. Whatever may have been our past education and experience, and of that, as we have just intimated, we leave those who know us to speak. In regard to our using abusive and ungentlemanly epithets, we can only say that we generally call things by their right names. We consider the Mormon leaders lying hypocrites and can find no fitter words to convey the meaning. We look upon the actual believers in Mormonism as dupes of the imposters and regard their faith as a foul and monstrous superstition, and must express ourselves so. If there is a more elegant and gentlemanly way of signifying the same thing, we have no objection to adopting it. But a skunk is a skunk, and it would not change the nature of the animal were we to call it an odoriferous, digitigrade, carnivorous animal.
The California American again. Western Standard, 3 January 1857. Our article, headed The California American on Mormonism, published in the Western Standard of the 20th Ultimo, has called forth a rejoinder from the editor of that paper, which we feel disposed to notice, though at the risk of being again charged by him with a desire to covet his attention. We have an aversion to newspaper warfare.
But when it failed in the manner we have been by the American, we should be, in our opinion, recreant to the cause with which we are identified and to every duty incumbent upon us, willing to allow it to pass unnoticed. Only courtesy will never prompt a man to call another a liar and publish it abroad, unsupported by anything but assertion. Much less will it influence him to denounce a whole community as lying hypocrites, impostors, and dupes, without advancing the slightest shadow of proof other than his bare opinion to support the charge. What would the editor of the American think were we to call him a dribbler, a political trickster, a man who would advocate any measure or support any candidate if he should only be paid enough? Were we to make such statements and publish them upon no other evidence than our mere say-so, the mildest terms men could use to us would be that we were low, abusive, and ungentlemanly. And the plea that we generally call things by their right names would avail us but little. Yet this would be equally as consistent and honorable a course as the one he has taken towards us in his articles. We have for nearly a year past been disseminating and advocating Mormonism through the columns of this paper. This is the only subject we had in view in publishing it. It may be presumed, therefore, that a tolerably correct idea of our doctrines can be gathered from its contents. Now, we defy the editor of the American to bring forward a single instance from it, or indeed from any of our publications or teachings, where licentiousness or immorality is taught and sanctioned. If Mormonism be such a system as he represents it to be, so vile and shameless in its everyday workings, he surely will have no difficulty in proving it be such from our writings. But we wish him to bear in mind that his idea of what is vile, shameless, and fanatical will not be the standard by which what we must be measured. That standard must be God's word and not man's opinion. We hope our contemporary will not run away this time with the idea, because we have noticed him again, that we covet his attention. We want him to be undeceived on this point. We have lived thus far without the attention of so respectable a paper as the California American, and we are not yet quite so low as to be under the necessity of resorting to it. The editor of that paper may rest assured, however, that whenever he gives vent to such sentiments as he has lately advanced regarding Mormonism and the Mormons, we shall never hesitate, by the assistance of that being to whom Mormonism owes its origin, to expose and condemn them. It won't surprise you to learn that at that point, California American gave up.
We're running out of time, and I'd like to leave a little bit of time for questions. So I'm going to skip to the last page and pick up Roger's first paragraph. Were the Mormons of mid-19th century America saints or sinners? The answer would have to be an unqualified both. Like most people, the Mormons had plenty of the good and bad among them. But to judge the entire religion, either for bad or good, on the basis of a single individual or the basis of a single tenet of their religion, such as the little understood principle of polygamy, would be completely unjust. Nonetheless, that is exactly what happened in the frontier West. Far too often, those who did the judging did so on the basis of second or third-hand information, often from those who had once been members of the church, but who had left with bitter feelings and personal grudges. And in the in its basic formulas, anti-Mormonism in the West was the same as prejudice in any other guise.
For a number of reasons, there's probably no need for polemicists such as the young George Q. Cannon in today's Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Nor is he likely to be remembered by many for his early years as the editor of the Western Standard, overshadowed as they were by his subsequent career as a business executive, political catalyst, and church leader. But Cannon's fiery editorials of 1856 and 1857 are worthy of historical memory. If nothing else, we must acknowledge the value of good writing and sound reasoning. Cannon was not without error, but the worst of his writings was infinitely superior to much of what passes for reasoned argument today. Perhaps just as importantly, he wrote with a flair and faithful sense of purpose rarely encountered at the beginning of the 21st century. The power and mastery of the early writings of George Q. Cannon reveal that something quite extraordinary was lost with the passing of the editor of the Western Standard and the feisty little newspaper through which he took on his world.
Time has only permitted us a brief glance at the many inflammatory editorials that made up the California Mormon newspaper wars of 1856 to 1857. But to give you an idea of the various issues that fed those wars, all of which contributed to the general question of whether the Mormons were saints or sinners, the following are the titles of the other chapters in the forthcoming book.
Two wrongs will never make a right. Samuel Brannan and the Vigilantes.
The pusillanimous railings of an apostate Mormon. The strange case of Elder Cannon and Mr. Hyde.
The bandits of the plains. Red Indians, white Indians, Lamanites, and Danites.
The grossest form of human depravity. Polygamy and the relics of barbarism.
The best news from this place is the Reformation. The rhetoric of reality. The reality of rhetoric.
Could be either way.
Either way.
The kingdom that Daniel saw, autocracy, theocracy, and theodemocracy in the desert.
The villainous wholesale calumniator, Judge Drummond and the friends of the court.
The hoary-headed reverend seducer, the assassination of Parley P. Pratt.
The Mormons must be crushed out. War and rumors of war.
A horrible massacre of immigrants, vengeance at Mountain Meadows.
Faithfully warning the people, Cannon's parting shots.
All appearing soon at a bookstore near you. Thank you.
Oh, I'd like to ask a question before we start with questions.
Wait, are you going to ask a question?
I've got one question. How many of you are descendants of George Q. Cannon?
At least one, anyway.
Oh. We have no, well, you probably, I'm sure we have some that just don't know it.
Well, and I'd like to thank you two gentlemen for this. Now, as a result of this session, I'm going to say that I will definitely be buying the book.
Well, that wasn't our purpose at all.
Well, the other thing is, I have an hour commute from work each day.
Yes.
And in the evening, you know, you get a little tired. I will definitely be buying the tape. But if you have any questions, I'd like you to have you come up. We'll either repeat it or have you come up and state your question.
Would you just recap a little bit what Sam Brannan was doing? Didn't he start a newspaper?
Oh, yes.
And what he was doing about this time?
Well, if you want the long story, it's in Volume 2 of the series. Volume 3 of the series, Scoundrel's Tale. And Brannan founded the California Star in Yerba Buena early in 1847. It was California's second newspaper, first newspaper in San Francisco, or what became San Francisco a month later. I believe, too, that Brannan owned a controlling interest in the Alta California, which, by a long genealogy, was the descendant of the California Star, although the evidence of that is circumstantial, and I've seen passing references. But I came across just recently a very interesting editorial written in 1858 claiming that the Mormons had purchased the Alta California. Now, the Alta was, among all the papers, perhaps among the most reasonable. It did very often take anti-Mormon positions. We have a number of articles in the book. But I think that Brannan was very powerful in San Francisco. I think he did have a controlling voice over the Alta, and I think he did try to minimize hatred of the Mormon people in general, although he did not mitigate the attacks on Brigham Young a bit.
Just add that there was quite a bit of concern about whether the California Star, Brannan's newspaper, was going to be an organ for the Mormon Church. And I think my sense is Brannan was sort of playing both ends on this, against the middle. He would confidentially assure Brigham Young, yeah, I'm putting together this newspaper and it's going to put forward our cause and it's going to really help out the whole program. And he was telling everybody else, no, this has nothing to do with Mormonism. And in fact, it did not really advocate for Mormonism.
They did have the first reports of the Daughter Party. A fascinating source on California history.
I'm curious as to what impact, how far-reaching was this exchange in Utah? Did the Deseret News or any of the papers in Utah pick up on this and publish it so that affected beyond that.
Well, of course, back then there was a free exchange of newspapers, so newspapers were always borrowing stuff from one another. The Western Standard republished a lot of things from the Deseret News. The Mormon, John Taylor, stole stuff from his nephew. His nephew stole stuff from him. So little bits and pieces of this showed up all over the place. The best, what really brought me into all this was coming across a book that Cannon later wrote called Writings from the Western Standard. It was a collection of some of his the editorials that he liked the best. He wrote it primarily for his posterity, and it's kind of hard to come by these days, but as I read that, I thought, man, this is great stuff, but I wondered, well, what was he responding to, and how did they respond to him? That's what led me to do the research to dig out all these old newspapers.
How many subscribers did the Western Standard have in Utah?
I can't remember numbers offhand, but there were actually more subscribers in Utah than there were in California.
And there were a number of agents for the newspaper, and I think that John D. Lee might have been one of them, but I know that Isaac Haight was the agent in Cedar City.
The subscriber question brings up my own, and that is, with all these newspaper articles flying back and forth, was there any discernible effect on the readership in California? And one other comment, and that is, Roger and I grew up in the same ward, and your declamatory style has grown considerably since we did roadshows.
Well, yes, it was a real open question how much good it did. I suspect he probably created as much dissent as he qualmed. There is one interesting exchange where one of his missionaries writes into him, letting him know that one of the reporters of one of these competing newspapers was asking for baptism. Now, whether he was ever actually baptized, I don't know. But the feeling was, the general feeling there was, you know, sort of like, whatever they say about us is okay as long as they spell our name right, you know. And so, in a sense, just having Mormonism out there in the forefront, providing a very strong defense for the principles of Mormonism, was felt that it was doing some good. I don't think there are too many newspaper editors whose minds were changed over the whole thing. But there were some newspapers who were quite solicitous in their attitude toward the Mormons and very understanding that they were a persecuted minority, and so it's not like every newspaper was out to get them, but certainly the vast majority, and certainly in California, and also as well as back east. This is very typical of 19th century journalism.
It's really very forgotten. Michael Landon at the LDS Historical Department has done quite a bit of work on this, and we'll have a volume in the series called West of Zion, Mormons and the California Gold Rush, that will show that California had a number of very large Mormon communities, including the second largest city in the state at San Bernardino. But the Standard served as a rallying point. I think psychologically it was very helpful for the Mormons to feel they had a voice. Cannon was absolutely brilliant in putting together a coherent defense of Mormonism.
I think we're about out of time.
The Roger's concluding statement about it being a bookstore near you. Few bookstores carry the series. The paperbacks are doing pretty well, and they generally run about $25 though. But if you subscribe to the series, Kurt Bench is taking subscriptions. He does a very good job handling them, and you get the hardback volumes, which are now priced at $40, at $32, and they will be highly collectible. David Bigler's volume is out of print, and it's a $100 book now. If you are building a library, you care about the history of Mormonism, it's a great deal, and we fear we. Roger's book is so long, we may have to bump up the price again, but these books are a bargain at the moment, and if you decide you eventually want to buy a set and they've already all been published, you'll be looking at several $1,000 investment if history repeats itself as it's done before and the Clark Company volumes become collector's items. But people say I'm a promoter. I am. I'm an independent historian. I don't have any retirement plan. I have to get out and do this, and so you guys have to put up. These are the commercials. You got to put up with it for the entertainment.
And I get so little out of it, I don't care whether you buy any or not. It would be nice to have a few of the
book's actually out there somewhere.
He's got to go sell them.
I'd like to thank you two gentlemen for this. It's been very enlightening. I've learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was excellent.
Oh, thank you.
Good job, Will. Thanks.
Now you got to develop an enthusiasm to get out there.
Oh, I think we did that.
Oh, sure. If you want a description or a
whatever you want,
with your name.